Hello and welcome to the Great American Novel Podcast.
My name is Kirk Kernut.
And I'm Scott Yarbrough.
In today's episode, episode 18, I believe, aren't we, Scott?
And I think it's 18.
We are going to discuss Kate Chopin's 1899 novel, The Awakening. So, Scott, tell me a little bit about your experience with this book and tell us a little bit about what it's about.
I think my experience of this started as an undergraduate having to read it in a Survey of American Lit class. It is, interestingly, as we'll see as we discuss the history of the publication of the novel, it is ubiquitous in every anthology, any course that talks about turn of century, 19th to 20th century American literature, talks about Kate Chopin. Any feminism in literature class talks about Kate Chopin. Any women's literature class talks about Kate Chopin. She is of... she's kind of everywhere, and she's very significant and very influential. The novel is about a young mother who's 27 years old in New Orleans, Louisiana, who is married to a French Creole man who is not particularly loathsome or evil or bad, but is very much boring. And she is not exactly fulfilled by being a mother and relegates most of the motherhood jobs to nannies and domestic help, and falls in love with a slightly younger, more dashing, flirty man named Robert Lebrun, and kind of dedicates herself to pursuing that relationship, although it may cost her in terms of status or family. It very much, as an 1899 novel, feels like it could have been written in 1969.
And I think part of the reason for that is Kate Chopin has a very interesting history. This is one of those types of great American novels that was lost for many years. Basically, after it was published in 1899, it went out of print very quickly and then was not rediscovered until about the 60s. It was taught here and there in the 50s, but it was largely rediscovered because of the feminist movement. And a book that it's often compared to or spoken of in the same breath as Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, which came out in 1963. So there was a historical context for rediscovering Kate Chopin. During her lifetime, Kate Chopin died at a relatively young age, 54, and really had only about a decade-long career in the 1890s. She was relatively well-known as the author of local color stories.
Right.
She was one of the most prominent producers in the first half of the 1890s of stories about New Orleans society, and in particular, the Creole society. And a lot of those stories were, she was very much influenced by a French writer named Guy de Maupassant. And one of the techniques that she absorbed from him was what we call the trick ending, or the ironic reversal ending, the type of story where the last line of the story totally recontextualizes everything you thought you knew. I think for that reason, maybe that was one of the contributing factors to the overlooking of her reputation for a long time. At a time when people were more interested in talking about craft in the 1920s or 1930s, the trick ending could seem a bit of a, as the word itself says, a trick.
Right.
But Chopin herself was married in a marriage somewhat similar to, I think, what we see in the Pontellier marriage in the novel. The husband she had six kids in 9 years.
Yep.
And although she remained devoted to her children, her husband died when she was just turning 40, or a little younger than 40, maybe even younger than that, now that I think about it, maybe 34. In terms of years, it was not that very long of a marriage. But she married him and relocated from St. Louis to New Orleans. And after he died, she went back to St. Louis. Never made a living off her writing, was largely supported through family investments. Did create a bit of a name for herself. When this novel was published in 1899, however, it created such a controversy that it effectively killed her career. Now, yeah, we want to be careful here a little bit, because there's some myths that surround the reception of The Awakening. It was never banned.
Right.
And I was fortunate enough to attend graduate school at Louisiana State with the major Chopin biographer, Emily Toth, whose book came out in 1990, right as I was there. So it was fun to see her success at that time and to read that book in that period. And that was a good 20 years after Chopin studies had been taking off. So it tells right. you how long it takes to kind of gather materials for a thorough biography. It did receive largely negative reviews, and Chopin was attacked for, I think, offending the public morality for appearing to endorse infidelity and for appearing to celebrate, I think, what will be one of the main controversies surrounding this book in our discussion is the question of a woman's biological devotion to her family and to her children.
Right. We would think, the presumption we would make is that you would have male critics who don't like the idea of a woman wanting to be able to leave behind the family and go out and search for new sexual fulfillment, romantic fulfillment, and which has historically been a somewhat more of a male prerogative in the West than a woman's prerogative. But really, that wasn't where most of the trouble came. It was in, there was a cottage industry of domestic women's novels that were largely reviewed by women book reviewers who kind of had a particular set of standards and expectations. And they were the ones who really railed against the awakening. And of course, they had one set of kind of understanding of who she was from her popular short stories. But she only worked on two novels, and this is one of them. And again, this one is published some 5 years or so before she dies. It really kind of cements her career. She doesn't really go anywhere after this with her writing. And it's kind of a little bit of a sad moment in that tradition of writers such as Zora Neale Hurston, we could name a number of others, who, because they're a little bit out of step with the editorial point of view of the time, are going to have to wait 50 or 60, 70 years to be discovered.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything in this novel that is necessarily any more shocking, perhaps, than what you would see in an Edith Wharton or maybe a little later, a Willa Cather. The adultery is not denounced, but and it is, you know, hinted at maybe a little bit more explicitly. Certainly, there's nothing explicit in the novel itself. No. But I think it is the portrayal of her thinking of it and her refusal to acknowledge that she maybe owes other people something,
right,
that her behavior owes something to her family or to her husband. I also think that, you know, if she had had the kind of literary support system that Cather or Wharton had,
right,
she probably could have survived it. You know, I think that this type of controversy, really, with her being in the Midwest and much of her reputation built around regionalism, that was a bit of a more conservative type of genre, I think, in terms of right. the types of readers that it reached. And they were just not prone to put up with this.
Well, and if she had not died so soon afterward, if she'd had yeah. time to come back with more books, that may have made them, much in a way that no one paid any attention to Maggie Girl of the Streets, and it was suppressed when Crane tried to publish it. And then after the Red Badge Courage becomes a huge nationwide hit, they go back and they rush Maggie into print because they had so ignored it and hated it when he first tried to publish it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you bring those two up, because that leads us to sort of talk about how we would classify this novel. And I think there's a little bit of a dilemma in it, because we could classify it historically with what's going on at the time that it was published, and then sort of aesthetically what it looks forward to. So you mentioned right. Crane and Dreiser, I believe, and those are two writers that are associated with the literary movement known as naturalism. So would right. you read this as a naturalist novel?
Yes and no, because I think it is absolutely a naturalist novel, and I'll define the term in just a minute. I don't think, unlike Crane and Dreiser and Frank Norris, who are card-carrying naturalists and want to have like a naturalist club and talk about naturalist topics and have brunches together, not that they do, I'm speaking, of course, with hyperbole here. I don't think Chopin knew necessarily what naturalism was or was paying attention to that kind of literary criticism. And I'm not sure when American critics began calling what Zola, who originates the movement, calls experimentalism and redefined as naturalism. But the notion is, following on the heels of realism and with the rise of movements in, in Darwinism and the popularity of Darwin's books and theories and the controversies springing up around them that spreading across the globe, combined with the philosophy of people like Nietzsche and combined with works by psychoanalytical thinkers like Freud, who I guess you could argue invents the modern social science and psychology. All these notions are in a swirl in the latter part of the 19th century. And all these ideas of science and social science that your fate is predetermined, that based on your heredity, based on either the natural world you're in or the social world you're in, that environment has some play on things based on the random occurrences and chance which happens. So, for example, your most simplistic version of this would be the story To Build a Fire by Jack London, where a man from the lower 48 states is up in Alaska in the winter during the middle of a blizzard where it's going to be 50 below zero. And his rationality has not been trained to deal with the environment. He's out of his natural range. He decides foolishly to walk 10 or 12 miles cross country to another camp, accompanied only by his Siberian husky. And the husky is, of course, in all ways prepared by his heredity and his conditioning and natural fit for the environment to deal with the extreme cold, whereas a man has no idea how to avoid stepping in a frozen over stream and getting wet and where to build his fire properly. But at the end of the story, the man, so out of his natural range, dies. The dog, in his natural range, moves on to the camp saying, oh, well, waited for that guy. Then it gets applied into matters that are social, and it becomes much more about the social environment. So the other kind of great American naturalist novel would be Native Son by Richard Wright. And part of what we find here is that characters are not the villains. The social circumstances are the villains. So New York of the 1890s and how it treats young women, how immigrants are treated, is the villain of Maggie Girl of the Streets. Catholic New Orleans and the choices allowed women is the villain of The Awakening. In right. The same way, Chicago of the 20s is the villain of Native Son, or the 30s, I should say. And so that application of scientific determinism into literature with the idea that the social environment is what we're focusing on is what I mean by naturalism. Now, you talked about how she's actually writing in a different cultural context, and I would say that would be the bulk of novels written by women, about women, and for women throughout the 19th century. And the whole stereotype or motif of the angel of the house and the domestic ending of the novel. Could you tell us about that for a minute, Kirk?
Well, there's a phrase that's often used. It's called the cult of true womanhood. And the idea was that the one social political power that women had was rooted in their identities as mothers and defenders of morality. So if you look at somebody like Harriet Beecher Stowe, much of the abolitionist appeal in Uncle Tom's Cabin is based on this idea of mothers, you should be outraged by these types of things happening in your households. And that sort of idea of women's dominant obligation is to the family, to protecting the children, to policing the husband, even.
Right.
It gets extrapolated in a lot of these novels. Now, there are constant challenges to it throughout. And again, I think by the time you get to the 1880s and 1890s, you see the emerging generation of realists like Wharton, eventually Cather, all questioning, you know, are these really just social dictates,
right,
keeping women in their place? But clearly, I think that Chopin is one of the more radical breakers of this tradition in that she
right.
is speaking openly, well, not explicitly, but openly about women's desire and about sexual desire in particular. And I think that's one of the reasons that she's often seen as looking forward to the modernist era. Now, this gets a little tricky because none of these literary genres or approaches are really defiantly breaks against each other. They all rise around or kind of build upon the same common pool of techniques. But with realism comes the emergence of a device called free and direct discourse. And that's a very powerful technique, creates a lot of controversy in Madame Bovary. Henry James will be probably the most...
he's your great poster child for sure.
Right, in American literature. And the idea here is simply that your typical omniscient narrator, like you would have in Uncle Tom's Cabin, is considered intrusive, so that voice is taken out and we rely upon a center of consciousness in order to dramatize. And the great mystery or ambiguity, the quality that makes the reading literary, is this question of, do we take the description of an author's feelings sincerely, or do we take them ironically? And without the authorial intervention, we really don't have that type of presence. Now, again, for realists, they would argue that, you know, you still have a kind of firm controlling hand through the very selection of, you know, James is a great one for all these kinds of architectural metaphors about balance and proportion and all of this. The modernists really kind of free up that idea and sort of center us in the mind. You know, the famous extreme outcropping of free and direct discourse will end up becoming interior monologue and stream of consciousness.
Right. With Joyce and Virginia Woolf being two great, and Faulkner.
And a lot of critics do draw sort of contingencies between, I think, Chopin and Woolf, in the sense that although Chopin never really breaks the narrational frame, in the sense that she never places us into Edna's first-person thoughts or feelings, that we do get a sort of intense immersion in there. We don't know, should we agree with this reaction to things? How should we judge or how should we evaluate the character? And so I think it's that intensity of her mindset that allows us to see it as looking forward to modernism.
Well, you know, this is a very familiar novel to people in terms of the story. The plot of the novel is very familiar to people who have watched lots of television movies and throughout the 90s to the present. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of Lifetime Channel. I'm thinking of the Hallmark Channel, but I'm also thinking of every other channel. The notion of a woman being trapped in a kind of unfulfilling, boring marriage and wanting out and wanting more out of her life than simply the day-to-day grind of it. And it's basically taking the kind of previous generation's notion of the midlife crisis where the man has to break free of constraints and applying it to women and saying, you know, what's good for the gander is good for the goose. But what they always do in those kinds of movies and so many more later day novels is they find ways to really take it easy on their main character.
Yeah.
So the husband will be abusive, or he'll be a drunk, or he'll be gambling away the family's cash down at the club.
Kind of a John Bobbitt type.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's so interesting to me about this novel is how courageous she is by being willing to let Edna not necessarily be an attractive character.
Yeah.
Always. So Leonce, her husband, is no one's thrill ride, but he's not abusive. He is a good provider. But he wants to go hang out with his buddies at the club most nights. And she gives us two kind of doppelgangers or foils, if you will, to give mm-hmm. us other points of view on things. And I think for a lot of modern readers, they're always surprised that Leonce is not a more negative character here than he is. And to me, that's the genius of the novel.
Yeah, I think it's probably a very realistic depiction of marriage at this time. I mean, this was in an era when companionate marriages were not necessarily the ideal, or if they were, they were only in kind of name only. I mean, at one point, Leonce did passionately pursue Edna and, you know, promised to make her the center of his world. But his idea of doing that is providing her a home and material possessions and
servants
and a sort of lifestyle. And I think What she is looking for is a sense of romance and passion, but also a sense of just being respected as somebody of her own entity and having something of herself, an identity separate from being the wife of and the mother of. And I think what comes clear through Léonce is he simply has no empathy for that kind of struggle. I mean, he just, his immediate reaction is to think his wife has gotten sick and gone bonkers. And,
right,
he even consults a doctor behind her back. And right, the doctor is fairly, he doesn't come quite out and say it, but it's pretty clear to him that he thinks he knows what's going on, which is the woman has had a sort of romantic crush on somebody. And that's its other cliche, is that I think we're wrong to sort of think that this is a novel about the desire for passion in life. It's really more the desire to be acknowledged as an individual, for women to be acknowledged as unique beings rather than as conduits for other people.
And it's a desire for independence.
Yes.
So one of the great scenes, you kind of have two reoccurring symbolic motifs throughout the novel. And the opening of the novel, all the well-to-do rich people from New Orleans are down at Grand Isle out in the Gulf having a beach week or two. And the women and kids stay out there all day. The men kind of take the train back and forth to jobs and work. And then you have a few wealthy enough not to be nailed down to a job type people like Robert LeBrun and Alcea Robin, who are hanging out with all the young married women and flirting with them and so on. And we have a scene where Robert, the man she will develop this crush for and love for, teaches her to swim.
Right.
And what she loves about it is she goes, how simple. And she thought she could lose herself on the horizon. And it's the idea that she can do things without having someone else to do it for her, mm-hmm. that she can be her own person. And I think one of the great divides it gives us is, what were the opportunities for a young woman of some status in New Orleans of the 1890s?
Right.
And of course, Edna, in the same way that Chopin is not a New Orleans person, but is from St. Louis, Edna's actually from Kentucky. And the marriage isn't quite prearranged, but like you said, it's halfway there. And the notion seems to be that she couldn't say, I'm going to hold off a marriage and go to college and study to become a professor of philosophy. She couldn't say, I want to be a dentist or I want to be an accountant. If she's poor, of course, there's no luxury at all anymore than there's ever been for anyone poor. And if she's exceedingly wealthy, there might be a little more opportunity to kind of go your own way. But if you're trapped in that world of the upper bourgeoisie, so they're wealthy enough to have service, but not so wealthy that they have multiple houses in multiple cities type stuff. She's on a track from the time she's a child. You must learn to be pleasing. You must learn to be attractive. You must learn to be able to
entertain
people. Exactly. And there's a great scene in this when she decides she's not going to be the domesticated wife anymore, when people have come to the house to call on her.
Yeah.
And she goes out for the day. And when he says, well, who called on us today? She goes, I don't know. Ask for the cards. And when they give them to her, she hands them to her husband. You care about this? I don't.
Yeah.
And it's one of the many scenes of her throwing aside these, requisite domestic chores and duties. And a young man, of course, is going to be allowed to sow his oats, to hold off on getting married until he's ready, to follow his whims and passions for a while without feeling like he's on a track. Now, of course, again, we're talking about people who are what we'd consider middle class and higher. If you're poor, you were caught in a meat grinder of society's expectations and requirements. And that's the world, of course, that Crane inhabits more in his writing. But here with Chopin dealing with people of the social classes that she knew and hung around with, we see that, again, the women didn't really have choices, which isn't automatically always going to be bad for them. Depends who the woman is, right? And we have her two friends who give us examples of how things can go differently.
Yeah. We should just mention that many of the names in this novel are French, and a great resource is katechopin.org, and they have a pronunciation guide to all of the names on there, which I always share with students and find very helpful. So the two kind of antipodes that she bounces between are Adele Ratignolle, who represents kind of the maternal Madonna figure.
Right.
And it's an identity that Edna really can't wrap her arms around, because she is a sensuous being, but all of her energy is devoted to taking care of her children. And in fact, in one of the most striking scenes, she goes and watches Madame Ratignolle give birth, and sort of overwhelmed by just the physical gruesomeness of this and what it costs the woman, and exhausted by the labor, Adele says to her, "Think of the children, think of the children." Right.
But Edna thinks of it as the scene of torture,
right,
not the beauty
exactly.
of motherhood,
yeah.
the joy of childbirth, yeah. the miracle of life, but the scene of torture.
And this is after she's given birth to her own two children.
Right. And Madame Ratignolle, she's always usually called Madame rather than her first name.
Right.
So it's very much emphasizing she's married.
Married.
Is always saying, spend more time with your husband. And of course, we're told about her husband. He spends time at home with his wife. He's funny. Everyone likes him. And so what we see is there's not a prescriptive notion here that women shouldn't be fulfilled by marriage and family.
Right.
That if that's what you want, wonderful. And Madame Ratignolle is a woman who has a lovely, beautiful life and who loves it in every way. And she serves as an example of who Edna could have been, but is not, because that's not who Edna is. And then our other example, Kirk, is her friend, the pianist,
Madame Reese.
And Mademoiselle Reese has clearly made it obvious that she chooses art of being a piano player over everything else, and has no interest in men, in romance. Students often are curious if she is supposed to be gay. I think that's probably stretching a little.
Yeah.
I think to Chopin, the whole point of Mademoiselle Reese is she doesn't need romantic entanglement in her life at all, because she has
art.
Art.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that people will often read this novel, and I don't think they're really right, is they want Edna to be Chopin and to be a writer who's not being fulfilled and being allowed to write, kind of merging it with The Yellow Wallpaper, which is that very much that kind of story.
Or Little Women.
And I really think the whole notion of the writing and the other things that Edna gets up to here is much more about freedom and independence and self-fulfillment than it is really the tale of a artist as a young woman.
Yeah.
And I think, in fact, she says the artist needs many things. One is a talent, which you can't earn.
Mm-hmm.
The second is a courageous soul that dares and defies.
Yeah.
And Edna does have that courageous soul, but it's more about, in her case, is, you know, the lantern, the green light at the end of the dock is Robert Lebrun,
mm-hmm.
more than art.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, I think one of the things that gets explored here is the idea of, although Edna is on one level supposed to be an artist, I don't think that that's ever really it's more of a diversion than anything else. One thing I think this novel really does well is question us is what point when we are constantly asking, are we happy? Are we satisfied? Are we fulfilled? Do we become solipsistic? And
yes.
sort of self-absorbed. And, you know, I think people will maybe be surprised when they look at the critical history of the book that there's not a lot of looking at Edna as a victim. I mean, people understand that the idea of the constraints or the naturalist idea of the environment being against the growth of the individual impedes her. But there's never a sense that, you know, she has something to express other than her feelings. I mean, she's totally inverted into herself. And in this way, I think, you know, she does resemble Madame Bovary a lot. She does not become quite as possession oriented. But I do think it's significant that both of them commit suicide at the end of the novel, because it's just impossible for either of them to understand how they can exist in a world where they can't do or have whatever they want. And ultimately, that is a kind of naive or immature outlook on life.
I think you're right, although it's interesting the difference in how they do it.
Yeah.
There's a certain disregard for others that Emma Bovary has.
Yeah.
And with Edna, what's interesting about her, it's more that passion for independence, that passion to be her own person. And I think we might say if she were coming of age, even as early as the 1950s, she would have been allowed to follow that passion more than she is, and certainly much more so today.
Yeah.
More than she ever is in the 1890s. But because of the time and day, she can't take a step back. And we have scenes where she gets angry at Leonce for, frankly, just not being able to understand why she's not doing her job as he sees it.
Right.
And she yanks off her wedding ring and throws it on the ground and stamps on it. And it doesn't hurt the wedding ring one bit when she does that. And it becomes pretty clear that you can't just wish away several years of marriage and two children.
Right.
And again, to me, this is what's courageous. Again, flashing back to the made-for-television movie or the Thelma and Louise type movie, for one that a lot of people have very fond memories of. Someone's abusive one of the things we spare them is they don't have children.
Yeah.
Because although we are comfortable in our society these days with saying women can be very unfulfilled in a relationship and should have ways to become fulfilled, we're not comfortable at all with the notion of women who are not good mothers,
right,
and are almost aggressively not good mothers. And we're told here flat out in this novel that, in short, Edna was not a mother woman.
Yeah.
And she talks about all the other women at Grand Isle, or so many other ones, flap about like birds protecting their precious brood. And they want to efface themselves as individuals. So totally subsume themselves to their job as being a mother. And Edna is just, I wouldn't say she's not cut out to ever have been a mother, but she's not cut out to have been a mother with someone she doesn't love.
Right. I think it's interesting to read the Awakening alongside a lot of contemporary novels that have come out in the past maybe 40 years about ambivalent mothers. And I think in those cases, there's still a lot of a sense of they usually return to some level of guilt or some level of frustration, unfulfillment. I think that reflects our own sense in the last 40 years that, you know, the kind of post-60s recommitment to family.
Right.
That, you know, became sort of such a cliche with the whole idea of family values. But we still tend to project that on women the most. I mean, yeah. if you know acquaintances that do not have children and are successful professional women, I think there is still very much in us a temptation to assume that in some level they have been unfulfilled in life.
Well, we are going to judge a mother who takes off on her children even yes. more harshly than we do. Yeah. I'm going to be judgmental on anyone who takes off and abandons children, no matter what. But I'm not. But I think a lot of people are going to judge the woman more harshly than they do the man because we're more familiar with men doing it.
Yeah,
we have in South Carolina is a famous case from, I guess, the 90s. It's early
90s. Yep, 1994.
Where a woman wanted to run off with a man and he didn't want to. And she thought it was because she had kids. And so she cooked up a story playing on the racism and everyone's racist fears that a black man kidnapped her children. And actually she drove him off into a lake to die, to drown, and tried to run off with the guy. And to his credit, he kind of figured out what happened and immediately told the cops. And her name's Susan Smith. And it's so horrible. Many people still know the name. You recognize what I was talking about immediately.
Yeah.
But of course, how many men have gone crazy and killed their families?
Yep, exactly.
In the intervening 30 years since that happened, or 25 years, whatever
it is. That takes us back to the way that she kills herself. And I think, you know, you asked a very important question about the differences between the death in Madame Bovary and the death here. When Emma Bovary kills herself, she eats rat poison. And it's a very gruesome, ugly death that absolutely shatters the illusion of the sort of beauty that she has pined for all her life. And I think that's the point where maybe the most definitive point in Madame Bovary, where you feel the author sort of critiquing the choices that this character has had. It's not a beautiful death. The swimming off into the sunset and drowning, I think there is a romanticized notion of suicide in drowning that Chopin is very much playing off here. Comes out of the Romantic era with Shelley, who of course drowned in the sea and is sort of immortalized in all of these beautiful statues of his gorgeous body that is not ravaged by nature at all. but it looks like a sleep. And what we don't get in here is maybe a little harsher of a view of drowning that we maybe see in Hawthorne's The Blithedale Romance, where Zenobia is pulled out of the river with rigor mortis, and it's a horrific sight. So I think right until the end, she rides this ironic line where you don't know, am I glorifying this self-abnegation, or am I ironically pointing to the way we delude ourselves with our solipsism?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that Chopin does in the novel that helps you kind of ride that line a little bit is she's really doing a great job of choosing these kind of little poetic renderings of nature.
Right.
And she repeats them as a refrain over and over again. You know, the one about the sea enfolds you in a warm embrace. One of the things that's interesting, too, is we see kind of predating modernism, just the use of modern style symbols in a way that are less common 19th century fiction. So whether it's symbolic event, for example, her father, the living symbol of patriarchy, comes to visit to see what's going on with Edna. And then she says, I'm not coming to my sister's wedding, meaning she's not going to be part of this ritual that is going to in some way or another subsume her sister's will to a husband's will. And that makes him angry. And you see that all played out. There's a scene where she tells the story of two young lovers poling a pirogue through a swamp and seeing the birds flutter up into the nighttime sky. And the doctor who, as you said, Dr. Mandalay, who's very sympathetic in the novel, later says, well, I hope to God it's not Alcea Robin, which is the kind of Weasley ladies' man that she does fall prey to briefly in her need to just kind of be with anyone after she can't initially land Robert Lebrun.
Right.
And the bird motif, of course, throughout the novel. Our opening scene is a bird in a cage saying in French, you know, get away, for God's sake, get away.
And irritating Leon's.
Yeah, and it really bothers Leonce. And so trapped in a cage, a gilded cage at the start, and when she's listening to the renderings of music by Mademoiselle Riche, she has a vision of a lonely person on the beach staring at a bird flying away in the far distance. And as she goes out onto the beach at the end of the novel, she sees a bird slowly spiraling down to earth with a broken wing from and one of the questions you might have is, how did it fly so high in the first place with a broken wing? But maybe it's been, you know, struck by a osprey or something. We don't know. And so that shows up an awful lot as well.
Yeah.
Kirk, what do you make of Robert Lebrun, our primary love interest in the novel?
Well, it's very interesting that the two main love figures, because again, we have a very similar contrast to what we have in Madame Bovary, where you have the sort of younger, more naive, romantic male, and then you have the charismatic, dashing ladies' man who's purely in for the seduction. I think Robert Lebrun is, well, first of all, when I teach this book, students often question, how is it in this culture that a young man is allowed to gamble about so much with the married women and have this kind of closeness of intensity with them? And I think, again, that's a very, very much a product of this particular Creole society. I don't think that you would necessarily find that in the Presbyterian world that Edna comes from. You know, the spheres of interaction were very rigorously separated in most American communities in the 19th century. So I think for Robert, the idea is he's simply a naive lover, sort of self-infatuated. But he also has that very male kind of self-crucifying notion of I am denying myself for your own good. I am protecting you. So it's because I love you that I'm going to run off to Mexico. And it's because I love you that when I come back, that I can't even fathom the idea of us ever being together.
Yeah, he's very much in that tradition of the Henry James characters who deny themselves.
Yeah.
And Newland Archer in a later novel, which we have would discuss before, The Age of Innocence by Wharton, who's very much Henry James's protege in some ways. But, you know, we're reminded of Frederick Winterbourne mm-hmm. with Daisy Miller and yes. his lack of willingness to break free of society and to challenge society's point of view because he's so wrapped up in it. He's not a Huck Finn who's already outside society. Didn't take much courage for Huck to break free because there's nothing to break free of, really. No one really cared what he did. But for Frederick Winterbourne or Edna to break free demands a lot of moral courage of a sort, which Edna has up to a point, and Winterbourne doesn't have it all, and Robert has up to a point where he can sleep with or fall in love with another man's wife,
yeah,
and eventually it's hinted sleeps with her, but can't commit to living with her, to being with her, to causing a divorce. And again,
because she's not free.
Right. In American society, divorce is becoming more common at this point, but not among Catholic society in the United States. And I'll say, of course, is kind of every port in a storm. And there's one of the most interesting super short chapters with White Space where she goes in to kiss him. And we hear that desired and kindled the torch or something like that. And then there's a break. Mm-hmm. And then she cries after he leaves.
Yeah.
And it's because it had not been the
experience.
Cup of love that had handled this itself to her lips.
I think one of the things that I do like that is a lot less satirical than Madame Bovary, when Emma succumbs to Rodolphe, who is the seducer, you know, she falls in love with him and he gets irritated by how much she wants from him and how much attention and how much acknowledgement. You know, to him, it's just a sexual conquest. I'm glad that Chopin doesn't dish that upon Edna. I think she deserves a little bit better than that.
Right. And we like that she also she's wanting to partake, and I'll say, as much as vice versa.
Right,
she kind
of
blows him off.
Yeah.
Because she's focused on Robert.
Yeah.
That's
an interesting reversal that will become more and more common throughout fiction, that kind of upends the idea of masculinity. I mean, you can think of recent novels and movies like Up in the Air, where the adulteress basically says to the male character, this was never anything more to me than about sex. And the guy sits there and says, wait, what? How can you do me dirty like this? And so I think that's a neat role reversal that still has not become cliche necessarily.
No. So, Kirk, we know it's American enough, and I think there's always a certain value to when we have there are little islands, in the United States, of cultures that are unique to that city or place that are not quite like other areas. And the most famous one, of course, would be New York. We could add to that Boston, Chicago, but also New Orleans is. You and I both know the city pretty well and spend a lot of time there, and it is to this day one of the most unique environments in the United States. So anything that gives us a little feel for New Orleans is, I think, good. I think the theme, these naturalist themes of the past laid out for women, of how they can in some way or another decide their own fate and not have it all set in stone for them by society ahead of time. And I think that in itself is, of course, incredibly important, and it's an American theme. Do you think it has enough? It's a very thin novel. Does it have the heft, the scope, the depth we need for a great American novel?
Well, I think the reception history tells you that traditionally it did not, but I think it has become one of those novels that challenges us to recast our idea of what the great American novel is. So I do think it is one. I would include it. You know, we saw with The Great Gatsby, a great American novel does not have to have the physical bulk
That's right.
to be great. doesn't necessarily need to have the epic sort of sense of spatial distance, of travel, of moving around. But this is a novel about a very fundamental American theme, which is self-making. And what it dramatizes in its very centrifugal way is the idea that what happens to the self when all of the energy is forced down upon the identity and you can't create yourself. Yeah. So I think it captures a very fundamentalist theme of what is the American individual and how do you ascertain that state of being self-made, of self-fulfilled?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great point. And you think of the Langston Hughes quote in his poem Harlem, you know, what happens to a dream deferred?
Right.
And later that gets used for the title and epigraph to the play, A Raising Sun. And we think of it in terms of African Americans, of Black people, and what they dealt with in American society during the days of segregation and before the civil rights advances are made. And at the same time, of course, we have to say what happens to a woman whose dream is deferred because of the structures of society which interfere with it.
Right.
And in terms of durability, you spoke to that as well. It suffers under the critical vantage point of its day, but with the development of a couple of good biographies in the 50s and 60s and rediscovered interest in the writer, the rise of second wave feminism in the United States, it has become a classic taught in every American literature class across the land.
Yep.
It's in every bookstore, it's in every anthology. And I think that in itself shows how solid a place is created for itself in the canon.
In fact, I saw a statistic the other day that said this is the fifth most taught American novel in according to syllabi. So now, again, the fact that it's short makes it a good candidate for teaching.
Right. And also means it can be in an anthology. You can't put a 400-page book in there.
But exactly. I think that you mentioned that it's ubiquitous before, and I think that you see a constant stream of adaptations of not only this novel, but many Chopin short stories, because those issues are still with us today.
Yeah.
Nothing about this novel that could not be translated into a contemporary novel, and, you know, much the same point being made. We still demand of women that you have this self-sacrificing notion of your identity, that it's not yours, it's for your children and for your family.
Have you ever had a woman student attack the novel?
I have not. I have not had that experience.
I have twice, and in both times they were what we call non-traditional students, which mean they're older than the 18 to 22, 23-year-old kind of five-year bracket we throw on that term traditional students. And they both had children.
Mm-hmm.
And as people who love their children, they just could not forgive her for not really caring about theirs. And of course, the discussion in class was, I'm presuming no one made you guys get married. No one told you this is the only thing you should do with your life. Your dream has to be find a guy who's got a lot of money and marry him. I suspect you were being told instead, you can be whatever you want to be when you grow up. You can do whatever you want to do when you grow up. You know, you can't be a spaceship or a whale to stay within the realms of realism, but you can be whatever you want to be. And that's the world that my daughters have grown up in, but was not around for Kate Chopin when she was growing up.
Right. It's that question of choice.
Yeah. So up for cannon fodder, I would like to say, as you pointed out with our discussion of Madame Bovary, there is a subversive reaction against The Angel in the House and the domestic women's novel of the 1800s, then it picks up steam in terms of value. We not only have Madame Bovary, we have Anna Karenina as one of, widely regarded as one of the greatest novels of all time by Tolstoy.
We have Hedda
Gabler. We have alternate kind of classes and approaches. You even have people kind of firing back, but in very realistic ways with the works of George Eliot, say, and so on. So the novel, I would say, that picks up where this one leaves off, and it's published just a few years later in 1904, 1905, is Edith Wharton's first really significant literary novel, The House of Mirth. Yep. Unlike her later books, that one, too, is very influenced by naturalism. is very much in a different register and a different tone and style than you see in her later works or in Chopin. It's much more feeling like a Henry James book in many ways. But again, she takes what James does and approaches it from a very particular feminine point of view. And you have a young woman, Lily Barth, who is like Edna, reacting against the constraints of her class, her gender, her time and day. But unlike Edna, she comes up some other ways that to follow or to follow those responses. And it's just it's already in the canon, so it's not perhaps quite what we should call canon fodder, but it's well worth your time.
It doesn't get as much attention as The Age of Innocence, in part because I think it is so critical of the marriage market and the idea right. that women's identity is defined by their marriageability. But it is a novel that emphasizes as well the pursuit of companionate marriage. And not to give it away, but it also ends with the main character committing suicide. So, You know, we see in that sort of fatalistic act, the lack of opportunities that women have in many of these narratives.
Kirk and I are going to be tackling some hefty reading over our holiday break, which is upcoming. And if you want to do some hefty reading and think about The Awakening further, you could read Portrait of a Lady by Henry James and Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert, and then The House of Mirth. And we, on the other hand, will be reading, because this is our next book we're going to cover, Kirk.
It'll be Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow.
And that one is a thick one, and we'll be putting in our hours here over the so-called break.
Thick and dense.
We thank you for listening to the Great American Novel Podcast. Please follow us on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. And if you're so inclined, please leave a review on these platforms. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you may also enjoy others such as Master of 40 with Kirk and Robert Trogdon, focusing on the short stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Rita McCarthy with myself and various guests about the works of Cormac McCarthy.
And you can always email us at greatamericannovelpodcast@gmail.com. We thank you for listening.